Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to Evan Ferrari, the executive director of Emerge Guelph. It seems like a dramatic oversight that it took us until episode number 163 to get Ferrari on the show, as he's become such a key figure in Guelph's clean energy and green tech scene. But it's never not a good time to talk about the environment, and there's so much to talk about. There's the City of Guelph's commitment to net zero and 100% renewables, changes to environmental policy at the provincial level, the carbon tax on the federal level, and the practicalities of how we, the people, can contribute to the cause. So, the practicalities of tackling climate change and creating energy efficiency is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, we could start this with the usual preamble about extreme weather, the 12-year deadline from the UN climate change report, the enigma of climate change denial, but let's take a moment to explore these issues on a more immediate level. That's where Emerge is. In its own words, Emerge fights climate change by helping people reduce energy and water use, by promoting smart behavior, policy, and improved efficiency to help Guelph built a roadmap to beat climate change and achieve 100% renewable energy by 2050. Emerge also wants to do this by diversifying the local economy and by helping people save money. Now, as it says above, last year the City of Guelph itself made a move to get 100% renewable by 2050. That means retrofitting older buildings to make them more energy efficient, updating the building code to represent modern energy efficiency standards, encouraging the use of renewable energy sources like wind and solar, and going to an all-electric vehicle fleet for both the City of Guelph and Guelph Transit. In the process, Emerge believes that this will create more good-paying jobs, attract more innovative businesses, save money on energy costs, and yes, save and restore the environment for generations to come. What sounds impossible on the macro-global scale seems easy on the micro-local. But is it really that easy? So this week on the Guelph Politicast, we put Evan Ferrari to the test. We talk about where Guelph is and where the world is on the battle against climate change, how the debate has changed in the last few years, and how the economic argument has ultimately proved to be very persuasive in getting more people to take action. We also talk about how Guelph is leading the way on a lot of these changes, obviously, including our own development community, who has seen the value of net zero builds and how the building codes itself is letting us down on that account. And since this is a political show, we do also talk about the politics, how the various levels of government are sending us different messages, and whether Guelph City Council should follow Kingston's lead and declare a climate change emergency. So I caught up with Evan Ferrari earlier this week in studio. Evan Ferrari, thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you.
I want to start with how you describe what you do. What does Emerge do? Because I feel like it's a well-known name in the community, but it's in so much as a lot of these things start, these episodes of the podcast, you know, we want to start with who you are and what you do. And
absolutely. Well, that may make it really simple. We fight climate change.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Emerge does. And how that manifests itself is through energy conservation and water conservation. And in the process of doing that, people can also save money. And an integral part of what we're doing right now is about the fact that we got the city to commit to 100% renewable energy by 2050. Mm-hmm. And now everything we're doing is feeding into that narrative, feeding into that work. And it all fights climate change.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to get too combative, but
because I am in favor of the fight.
But one of the things that was striking me preparing for talking to you in an official capacity today is that It sounds when you read the Emerge website, you make it sound so easy. When it gets down to that local level, we do all these little things. It adds up to an effect on the fight. And I feel like it feels like the exact opposite when you take you look at the bigger picture, the global picture,
yeah,
in terms of what that looks like and how those small actions on the local level translate. And I guess what I'm wondering is, for years, when you're talking about the environment, it was talking about think globally, act locally. Is that still relevant, though, when we've got the UN saying it's 12 years till the deadline?
That wasn't, those aren't fighting words. That's an easy, the only things to actually affect real change have come from really small, consistent actions that people have taken. There's no question that we've got a time crunch on our hands. But what's also become very evident with the broader public, not those so immersed in climate change, but with the broader public, that they're getting a little bit of fatigue with that messaging. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that the messaging isn't correct, that we are in a dire situation. But what we're trying to provide is a solution. And what some of the data is suggesting from the polling nationally and internet and throughout North America is suggesting that people are being frightened to inaction.
Mm.
And our attitude is there's a hell of a lot that we can be doing, and you can start today. And it will all have an impact on things. We need to give people hope because, frankly, if all we did was to constantly repeat the data that's been out there forever, it's being repackaged, and new science is happening all the time, and it's critical that we continue to do the science. We need to give people hope.
Right. You mentioned that the only thing that's really changed about the science is that it keeps getting closer. Is that the worst case scenarios just keep getting closer?
Yep.
I wonder though, you know, a lot of what drives us in life, and I don't even mean like things like as existential as climate change,
mm-hmm.
but fear. Like, you know, you study for a test because you fear about failing and ruining your life. You do a good job at work because you worry about, you know, being impoverished and homeless because you don't have a job. It seems like the opposite works in climate change.
It's not scaring us,
yeah.
is it? I mean,
yeah.
Sorry, but let me step back from that and just talk about polling again.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what we also see from the polling is that the public is way ahead on politicians on this stuff.
Sure.
And I think to a large extent, sometimes the populace is looking for political leadership on it. And let me be really critical here, but by and large, politicians follow. They don't lead when it comes to an issue. I know that's going to be a shock to you and your listeners. But frankly, many politicians are going to, you know, take the temperature.
Sure.
Where are things? Oh, my God, X percent, you know, 80% of people are interested in something like this. And of course, not only is there the public opinion piece, but then there's the influence of very large multinationals. And then there are individuals and organizations that are politically motivated not to see this happen for a whole myriad of reasons.
Sure.
So this is more than just people passively sitting by and hearing the pros and cons. You know, there's no doubt that there's been a concerted, well-funded obfuscating communication plan that's been going out there for a time. So our attitude is the science is unequivocal. You know, I'm not interested in having a discussion with a climate change denier.
Right.
Their time is over. That if they want to argue over which is the fastest way to get the job done, I'm happy to have that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many things that we can do and that people can do. And I keep trying to find the hope in all this because, frankly, if I don't find the hope, I'm not climbing out of bed in the morning.
Right. Yeah, I do wonder about, as you said, people are hyper aware. I think climate change denial is more of a political and economic phenomenon than it is necessarily coming from like a sort of a grassroots perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I still wonder because when you talk about that polling mm-hmm. and people tend to list their priorities. And this comes in to a certain extent, and I saw this online yesterday. Somebody on Twitter posted, you know, we have the oceans dying, we have forests disappearing, we have deserts taking over, we have drought, we have floods. It should be on the front page of every paper. It should be the above the fold story, the planet is dying. And I almost feel like the same in some of the explorations I've done recently about homelessness. It's like these existential issues, unless there's like a protest somewhere, unless there's a conference somewhere, it's really hard to galvanize our attention as a media, as a media industry to cover this issue, I think, effectively or even with regularity.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good assessment of it. our approach in communicating things is to try to find where people are interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is that there's a huge portfolio of things that people can do right now that have a positive impact on mitigating climate change. I don't want to preach to you, you should become a vegan today. What I want to understand is what's of interest to you.
Yeah.
You know, and there are a lot of things. Our attitude is take someone where they're at and move them along the continuum of things that they can do.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, and much to my surprise, that has really caught fire, and this is coming from a guy whose last name is a car, and I've never owned a car, and I'd rather people walk, bike, or take transit. What's really surprising me, and this is a piece that's giving me hope, and I'm going to qualify what I'm about to say one step further and say, I don't always want to hang my hat on technology, but what's happening in what we call the energy transition towards renewables and the electrification of everything and forgetting about fossil fuels is that there in some of these sectors we're seeing exponential growth.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the piece that gives me the most excitement because it's extremely difficult to properly forecast exponential growth. That inevitably what happens, so let's take the situation of electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2 years ago, we picked up some mud, said, let's throw it at the wall, see if it sticks, and said, let's try an electric car show. Mm-hmm. We had 5,000 people show up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we were really surprised, and we targeted a much broader demographic rather than people that are already drinking our Kool-Aid. You know, that we need to get to a broader group of people. Needless to say, there are certain car manufacturers that have made it really sexy and cool and you know, that piece of it. But by and large, this wasn't the cool crowd that was coming up. These were people that were genuinely interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
In year-over-year numbers, I'm going to throw out some stats. In the first three quarters of 2018, total passenger vehicle cars sold in Canada, 8.2% were electric vehicles. The previous year, it was just over 2%.
Wow.
Now, that's not to say that it's gonna grow that. Even if it grew by 40 to 50% year over year, that's quite profound.
Yeah.
And right now, there's a suggestion that it could approach 100% of new car sales before 2025. Some are suggesting as early as 2023, which is, I know the 20s sound around, you know, sound further than they really are, but that's around
next
the corner.
Year.
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty damn quick. So that excites me in that while I know, going back to, I know what I prefer people to be doing,
right.
But to make a simple decision about a car, which isn't always a simple decision, and I know they're more expensive, and I know there are reasons why people think that, you know, that they don't work, and we could spend 3 hours and I could dispel all those myths out there.
Sure.
And we're actually going to do that in June with an electric, a thing we're going to call, Are You EV Curious? not only are we going to dispel those fears and have test drives, but what we're also going to do is we're helping to launch a new rebate program for used EVs.
Okay.
Because up until now, people are saying, yeah, that's cute, Evan. I don't have $100,000 or $65,000 to buy a Tesla.
Right,
and of
right.
course, what percentage of the population buys that kind of technology, but those that can afford it. But let's rewind the tape to the early 1900s.
Mm-hmm.
Who was buying cars?
Sure.
Those that could afford Teslas today. That
yeah.
same demographic. Whenever we have...
Well, it was kitsch.
Yeah, kitsch and cool.
You yeah.
know, I have the money to burn, to run out and spend a huge amount of money, $500, on this car.
Because, if you look at the old cars, they're rickety, and it's not like there are really great roads
no.
at the turn of the 20th century.
Horrible,
yeah.
horrible roads.
Yeah.
So it was... The automobile, the gasoline automobile, was a disruptive technology.
Mm-hmm.
And by virtue of something called a disruptive technology, it's a technology that has massive economic, social, and environmental implications.
Mm-hmm.
Cell phone, the telephone in and of itself, the refrigerator, the wheel, all of these things were, I mean, in different time frames, disruptive technologies. We're on the edge of this happening. And
right.
we see that we know not everyone can afford a new car, let alone a new electric car, but we're going to help kickstart the secondary market in electric vehicles to get more people excited about
right.
these things. So that's, I mean, that's one example, but the exponential increase in the production of renewable energy at the same time, the exponential decrease in the cost specifically of solar and to a
right.
lesser extent wind scaring the bejeepers out of the fossil fuel industry. So the rhetoric is only going to heat up.
Is that having an impact on... I don't want to get too much into the politics of building pipelines, but it really seems... I don't know. I don't think this could be just me talking, but it doesn't seem that simple, or as simple as the government's just not supporting pipelines. It seems to me that, as with a lot of sectors, including my own, there's a lot of uncertainty. Nobody knows where the end point is. Nobody knows where the story is going. Is there that kind of uncertainty too in the energy sector, where people are like, I see the value in investing more in solar, investing more in wind. However, every night on the news, there's a story about how we're leaving poor energy workers in Alberta behind.
The economic impact. Well, let me repeat. These are disruptive technologies.
Right.
And if you were a buggy manufacturer, or you were a blacksmith in 1900, chances are you didn't have a job. Within the next 10 or 15 years, there will be massive shifts in economics and in society and around jobs. But let's use the example of Norway for a second. Mm-hmm. Norway is at least as big. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's a significant oil exporter.
Right.
They have had a significant levy on oil, and they've turned around and pumped that back into the community from that's supporting all sorts of social programs, healthcare, education, to the extent that it's an extremely wealthy population. Their attitude is that they are slowly, but all of the money that they're getting out of the oil industry, they are divesting from the oil industry and putting it into renewables in Norway and around the world. Mm-hmm. What we've done in Alberta, and I say we're not in Alberta, but we're part of the country,
sure.
Needless to say.
Yeah.
Alberta used to have the Heritage Fund and has been slowly dwindling it. What they pay, and I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but it's a fraction of the royalties that were paid in Norway. And what Norway's been doing is transitioning those employees over to that new energy transition, making that transition happen before that market for oil dries up, and they continue to have a robust economy. What are we doing in Alberta and Canada? Saying, oh my God, they're going to lose their jobs. Let's continue to burn fossil fuels.
Right.
It's extremely short-sighted. Unfortunately, the political narrative that's happened in the country, and in more so Alberta specifically, you can't touch the oil and gas sector. Mm. Even before the federal government bought the pipeline, yearly, the federal and provincial governments subsidized oil and gas to the tune of $3 billion.
Most in the G8 or G7.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So the numbers are huge. And what I always love was that there were initial people called subsidies to renewable energy in Ontario, and now they just don't exist anymore. There's no reason for them.
Mm-hmm.
So in less than a 10-year period, it went from subsidizing it to no subsidizing it. So generally with industry, we subsidize them because they're in a nascent stage and they need to get on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
The oil and gas industry has been around for over 100 years.
Right.
They're not even in their mother's basement in their 30s.
Right.
They are still in their cradle and saying that you need to do everything for us, including pouring huge bags of money. So frankly, I don't buy the argument. Politicians have done a wonderful job on playing on that, oh my God, I've got a $100,000 a year job in the tar sands and I've got three trucks and I have to maintain this. What are you going to do about this?
Right.
And I would argue that regardless of political stripes, that anybody that's in power in Alberta has no choice but to pander to that, or they're not going to get reelected. And frankly, I don't think anything the NDP could do could actually save them from not being, from being elected, not being elected rather in Alberta.
It seems bizarre to me that you have people making the point that we don't pick winners and losers in the economy. And that's
then stop subsidizing the oil and gas industry.
Well, I was just going to say, that's always the argument against subsidizing
anything,
wind and solar.
Anything.
Right.
Yeah.
But we do subsidize heavily one winner.
And the nuclear industry, by the way, as well.
The nuclear?
To a huge extent. Yeah.
Nuclear plays no part in net zero, you think?
What I'm encouraged about is that the cost of renewables and the functionality of it and the ease of use is going to become so good that it's going to render nuclear completely, well, it's already uneconomical. We will never build another new system because the cost makes absolutely no sense. There's no long-term solution to the waste side of it, and you're comparing that to wind, solar, storage, and a whole series slew of other things out there. I think that it provides us a good window of transition, and Pickering is expected to be shuttered in the 2020s at this point. The nuclear industry is pushing in a big way, but it's not renewable.
Right.
I mean, we're talking, you know, nuclear fuel is renewable in terms of billions of years before you get that fuel again.
Right.
So it doesn't fit the narrative at all. And as I said, I see it in the short term as an opportunity to do some bridging, but it just makes no economic sense. And they're trying to come up with all sorts of new products and ways of selling it, and I don't buy it.
So it doesn't even have to do with Fukushima. It's just... There's an economic argument.
You don't even have to consider that.
Yeah.
You don't even have to consider it. I'm glad you brought Fukushima up, because one of the things you said earlier is that, you know, you questioned, do the actions of individuals ever matter and to what extent? Now, granted, this was a crisis, but post-Fukushima, the city of Tokyo, a city of 20 million people, lost 20% of the electricity coming into that community.
Right.
The powers that be said, folks, you've got to conserve. You know, there wasn't enough time for everybody to put solar panels on the roof or do whatever. You just need to do a better job of conserving energy, or we're going to have rolling blackouts. So 20% sounds like an awful lot when you're thinking 20 million people.
Mm-hmm.
They had zero blackouts and zero brownouts as a result of it. Now, it's a crisis. We're in a crisis today on climate change. And frankly, we've been in homes as part of our home tune-up program, Emerge has, where we've seen people strictly through behavior and conservation and efficiency, you know, without spending an awful lot of money, consume at half the level that their neighbors would. So there are ways of doing this without running out and buying a Tesla or buying out a new net, you know, going out and buying new net zero homes. Granted, all new construction should be to that, you know, net zero energy or a model, but there are things that people can do from a behavioral standpoint that have had a profound impact on things.
I'm glad you brought it to the home level, because I wanted to bring up something you said on the Protect the Moraine tour a couple of months ago. You said building code is the worst possible construction that can be built legally from an energy perspective.
Yes, absolutely.
What does that mean?
So to put that into context, I'll throw out some numbers, but thankfully the numbers work close to 100. So the average new home built today, for all of your heating, for all of your cooling, you know, for all of your heating and cooling side of it, all the other energy that you use in home, it's about 100 gigajoules. Based on the building code today.
Right.
A net zero or a passive house, these are state-of-the-art homes, their comparable amount would be about 45. So that's a massive reduction in energy use. And that's not building code. These are builders that are going out and pushing the envelope on this stuff. And people might say, oh my God, it must have a million solar panels on the roof. Well no. And when we talk about 100% renewable, it's not about putting solar panels and wind turbines on an SUV, because that's what we've got now. If that's all we did was take that horrible building code.
I hope it's windy today so I can watch TV.
Exactly. If all we're doing is taking that horribly built home and sticking solar panels on the roof, we're wasting energy more efficiently.
Right.
So instead, imagine now the problem is 65% less.
Mm-hmm.
Now all of a sudden you need a lot fewer solar panels to put on the roof. So that's what that's about. And people say, well, then what does it mean? If it doesn't mean just sticking solar panels on the roof. If you go into a net zero or a passive house, the most important thing that you'll see there is what you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
It's about building the home tight with very efficient walls, very efficient windows. By and large, visible to most people, other than the window wells are going to be thicker. You have places to put books and things. The second piece is that you're going to electrically make sure that you have sufficient ventilation. So build it tight, vent it right. And once you've actually built to a standard that's by far blowing the building code out of the water, now all of a sudden you can put solar panels or buy as part of a co-op that owns solar panels somewhere else mm-hmm. to completely offset the energy that's out there. Mm-hmm. So this exists today. And I will say that there are over 50 homes built to that standard in Guelph right now that are operating. 50 homes. And those are 8 different builders. So it's not like it's one builder that's, you know, that's just pushing right. us like crazy. And generally, it's somewhere between a 10 and a 12% premium on the home. The downside of that, one builder who builds custom luxury homes says he loves doing this. But when he brings it up, people want to talk about the marble floors or a marble staircase or a marble right. a countertop.
Right.
That what we need to do is to make this sexy. Mm-hmm. People need to understand that this is something that we can all do and have a profound impact on.
How do you make it sexy though? I mean, I would find it appealing, and I think there's the business case, and I think the business case is working, that
Agreed.
You know, you're going to save money on your hydro bill every mm-hmm. month, but you watch those, you know, we're going to flip this home shows or the Property Brothers
yep.
or whatever,
yep.
it's always about the bigger bathroom, the bigger
exactly.
closet, it's never about, like, vent, what was the line, vent it well?
you caught me off guard.
Build it tight, vent it right. Yeah.
There you go.
So you know,
it's the last thing on most of their list. There's no
yeah.
question. And so no, it's an excellent question. But think of it in terms of something like recycling.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect that in the 80s, if we were having this conversation, you would have asked the same question.
Right.
And I think what it boiled down to is that there is no one answer to that. It's about consistent marketing and communications about this is something we all need to do. And, you know, people inevitably tell me, oh, I'm so upset my neighbor put something in the wrong. You know what I mean? Like, people are passionate about
right,
this.
Right.
And I think that you're right. We need to get to that point. The fact we've got 8 builders excites the bejeepers out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And those 8 builders, as part of the Guelph Home Builders Association, one of their builders kicked off this net zero, challenged her competitors to build the same. And the interest, I went up to her afterwards at this meeting and saying, like, why would you want your competitors to be building it the same way? And her answer was, I thought, was quite remarkable. She said she was looking at that point as much as a 15% premium on the house for a net zero home. And she said that that's because a lot of the trades don't have a clue about this stuff.
Mm.
So the more of her competitors that were doing this, the more trades that are familiar with it, all of a sudden they can shrink that cost so that it's no different
right.
than that horrible building code that we've got.
Yeah.
So she was actually looking out years. You know what I mean? Like she was looking forward and seeing that it could help her business. Because if we came to you and said, you know, we can sell you this house for this price or this house at exactly the same price, one of them is going to use 65% less energy and you're going to be more comfortable in it. Which one do you want to buy?
Right.
I think, you know, it's a pretty simple answer there.
I find that remarkable. How easily the economic piece of this, because, you know, instead of having one contractor who can charge whatever he wants because he's the one, you get 10 and you get competition going, and you know, we're off to, you know, it's like an economics class.
Absolutely.
It's just bizarre to me that it's still this left-right dichotomy, that it's the hippie everything
yep.
for free
yep.
environmental people versus the everything has a cost, because it seems to me, again, people get it.
I'm glad you brought that piece up, the cost piece. The economics of this stuff makes a heck of a lot of sense. What we want to do, there's $500 million a year that leaves Guelph, $500 million in energy costs.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the overwhelming majority of our hydro bill leaves here. It's a small amount of it that stays here, you know, that for distribution purposes. Most of the generation comes from outside of Guelph coming in.
Right.
Even higher percentage of all our gasoline usage and a higher percentage of all of our all of the costs we put into natural gas. If we do this conservation, efficiency, and then renewables thing well, we keep more of that $500 million here.
Mm-hmm.
We put you and me to work, you know, putting in new insulation somewhere, or a car dealer now, you know, providing an electric vehicle window installers. There's a whole myriad of things that are associated with it before you even get to the solar installers and those types of organizations. So imagine this is about creating more of a circular economy at the same time.
Right.
Keeping more of that money. You can't insulate a home in Fort McMurray and think that we're going to see an economic benefit here.
Right.
By the same token, by continuing to send that those dollars out of the city, we're not really helping us here a hell of a lot. And each community across the country needs to do this because we become a lot more resilient as a result of it.
So what needs to happen next? You know, where in order to keep this train moving, and I think you'd probably agree that we're in terms of a lot of these initiatives, we have things pretty good here in Guelph. What are we missing? Where does this have to go next in terms of building that momentum?
Well, before you got to the last part, I was going to say we need a critical mass, and it's. I try to keep the end goal in sight, mm-hmm. and so we continue to try to engage more and more people with things that people are interested in to grow the interest in electric vehicles. We were surprised to see a stat that in Guelph, we're 10% above the provincial average in electric vehicle ownership. Mm. By the same token, we're 150% or essentially 50% over the provincial average with residential solar systems in Guelph. We also know we have a really high utilization rate of our recycling, albeit plastics are a pain to recycle and we're having problems with that, but people right. actually using it properly, the utilization rate is remarkable. Mm. You know, we're well over 90% when it comes to compost, composting or putting the right materials in the compost. Mm. In Waterloo, it's 25%.
Really?
And we've had a history of over 20 years of getting this right where the community pushed this.
Yeah.
And unfortunately in Waterloo, it came as a bit of a top-down thing. So what we're trying to build is that bottom-up approach. It becomes much more robust than a government coming in and, you know, wagging their finger at us and saying, you know, we're all now going to do this. So we need to continue to build that up. And I guess as I mentioned earlier, that ultimately politicians are going to follow. And
right.
so we need to make it easy for politicians to say yes. My goal is never to argue with a politician. My goal is to come there with sufficient evidence and support to make it easy for them to say yes.
Well, let me propose something here in that you have, because it almost sounds like you're making an argument for no government interference. Let this be a top-up initiative versus a top-down, because we have one government at one level that is bringing in carbon tax, trying, some would argue, clumsily to make it a priority. And we have another government that there were initiatives to push some of these things we're talking about, and then they rolled that back. And it seems like the average person in Ontario caught in the middle between these two things.
It's horrible.
And, yeah. and just, you know, from what I'm gathering is it needs to be from the people up. And that's the Guelph example, shall I say?
Yes. You said that eloquently. Yeah. Two things come to mind, especially, our provincial government, you know, made huge changes on the climate change front. They also introduced a version of it that mm-hmm. obviously, you know, didn't quite have the teeth of the previous one. But what, you know, people were saying, oh, it's horrible. And I'm saying, well, no, it's actually pretty fantastic. And I don't mean that from a policy perspective. I mean it from the standpoint that politically, they feel enough heat that they need to do something, mm-hmm. or at least appear to be doing something on it.
Right.
so that's a lot more than I had expected that would have been coming from it. The other thing that I found very encouraging recently, that's just within the last week or two, is that they've been seriously floating the idea of banning single-use plastics.
Right.
I just find that really interesting. Now, that might be partly due to the fact that perhaps they see a need to show some environmental leadership on something. But
right.
I don't care what the motivation is at the end of the day. But we know that there's an economic argument to be made and an environmental and a social argument to be made for fighting climate change. And choose one or choose multiples. And we're happy to help.
Well, I was talking to somebody about that, I think, yesterday. And it's, you know, when the government accidentally falls into the right answer. We should support them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I think that's the case with plastics. I'll ask you one more question. We had Kingston declare a climate change emergency.
That was remarkable. Yeah.
Do you think Guelph should do that? Because I think you would be one of the people who would be at city council speaking to that motion.
I think that council would probably be receptive to that idea. Yeah. I don't see that as a bad thing at all. And I think one of the things that would help provide communities that start joining that is they're all part of something called FCM, the Federation of Canadian Municipalities.
Right. Yep.
So now all of a sudden, if FCM was to go to the federal or provincial governments in their respective or territorial governments and go to their respective next tier governments and be able to come to the table with this, that's pretty remarkable. Let's use the example of the United States. The current federal administration has been pretty clear on where they stand on this stuff, but remarkable work is being done at the state level in places like California. But there's a small town in Texas that is a net energy producer from a renewable energy perspective, and it's a dyed-in-the-wool Republican area.
Right.
And this is a place where they get the economics of it, of being 100% renewable. So there are communities all over a place where they're being told, don't do this, it's stupid. And they're being stellar about the work that's going on out there. So I keep hanging my hat on those ones and saying, regardless of what happens with, trying clean coal and all these other crazy things that are out there, there's a lot of fantastic success stories out there. And I think the municipalities is a good starting point, like this little town in Texas and Kingston here and us with our 100% renewable and net zero carbon by 2050. It all just dovetails perfectly together.
Be a climate leader like Texas. Seems like a good place to leave it on.
You have a future in marketing there.
I might. We'll see how this goes. But Evan Ferrari, thank you for your time and your expertise today.
Thank you, Adam. I really appreciate it.
And once again, that was Evan Ferrari of Emerge. And you can find out more about Emerge and its services at their website, emergeguelph.ca. And you can take part in the Eco Market, sponsored by Emerge, on March the 23rd from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Old Quebec Street Mall. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And you can help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph by considering a donation to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.